student body member shall now and why appellate counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Wilson Pasley. I represent Russell Elber in his appeal of two issues from the Roanoke City Circuit Court. The first of which is whether or not a Chapter 13 debtor has standing to bring a suit that is a part of the case that arose after the petition was filed and after the Chapter 13 plan had been confirmed. This court has held on at least two prior occasions that a Chapter 7 debtor who has not exempted a cause of action and has not had that cause of action abandoned by the trustee has no standing. However, this is a Chapter 13 case that involves different circumstances. Chapter 13 debtor, unlike a Chapter 7 debtor, has to pay off all of his or her debts, and as such gets to keep possession of all property in the estate to help him do that. The property in the estate necessarily includes causes of action that are part of the estate, such as the cause of action that is the subject of the suit.
Well, if that's the case, why wasn't it identified as a controlled claim on the original schedule of assets or amended at a later point? And then ultimately, why was it given a $1 valuation when the flood claim was $5 million?
Judge, I cannot answer why it wasn't amended other than what my client has told me, which is that he basically did not know he had to do that. Now, as far as the
prior attorney filed a motion to withdraw that gave an explanation.
Yes, sir, that was me. I spoke with my client after speaking with him, and after the reply brief was filed, I decided I should not withdraw.
Fair enough. I'm not implicitly criticizing you for that.
Yes, sir.
But tell me why judicial estoppel is not a reasonable application. Because it does look like one court is being told one thing, arguably misled, whether innocently or not, but not given the full story on exactly the issue, which is there such a claim? And another court is being told something completely different. And the federal courts historically have always seen judicial estoppel as something that the court has the capacity and sometimes the duty to raise and respond to protect the integrity of judicial proceedings. So help me with that.
Judge, our issue with that is basically the timing of this. This was raised not necessarily by the court, but by the opposing party at a late date. Where there was basically no notice. And even if there is authority to raise something sua sponte, our position is that we should have had more time to respond to that.
Okay, can I interrupt you one more question?
You may.
I get the first point, which it was not identified as firm defense, but for purposes of the question, assume it doesn't really matter since it could be raised sua sponte and the trial judge did in fact rely on it. Is it clear in the record that if you had been given an opportunity to respond, you could have offered an explanation for why judicial estoppel would have been inappropriate? And was there a proffer of that? In other words, when the trial judge said judicial estoppel, did you say or did someone say, you know, I can see how you might think that, but really there's some curious circumstances. If you give me a chance to put on some affidavits and evidence, I promise you, Your Honor, I can address your problem with this.
Judge, off the top of my head, I cannot remember where that happened.
Well, don't we need to know that? Because we couldn't, on this ground, if we reversed and sent it back, we have no idea if there's any curious circumstances at all, in which case we've done something for nothing.
Judge, the only thing I can tell you on that, and this is not something that we brought up because I found the case, and apparently nobody else found this case. In Virginia, judicial estoppel has to be the same parties to both cases, and that was not the case here. So I guess my argument would be if it was reversed and sent back, it probably probably would not, at least based on the law that I've found, it would not hold. But I will concede that we did not find that and did not argue that. I don't think I have grounds.
Privity was not argued in the trial court, right? The absence of privity.
Yes, sir, that's correct. It was not.
Counsel, it's an interesting point that previously judicial estoppel has always been interpreted as the same parties.
Mm-hmm.
But in a bankruptcy proceeding, there are no, you don't have two parties. It's an in re proceeding. Would that be an important distinction? That here the estoppel came because there was only one party. There could not possibly have been two parties in the prior proceeding.
Judge, as I understand the bankruptcy, there can be multiple cases within the bankruptcy. Now, certainly the defendants or the appellees in this case were not parties to the other suit. On the other hand,
They couldn't be parties because the action had not been disclosed to the bankruptcy court or the bankruptcy trustee. So it remained an in re proceeding. There was no other litigation that had been brought into the bankruptcy court.
There is the if other litigation had been, they could have been a party in some sense to the bankruptcy. There's the possibility of that.
I guess what I'm saying is that the only reason or the primary reason why both parties were not before the court at that time was because your client had not disclosed to the court that there was the possibility of there being another party. Do you understand the conundrum?
I do. But, I do think there's a distinction there in the sense that if litigation ensues and both parties are before the court, that's traditionally what this court has looked for in terms of whether judicial estoppel would apply.
Because we always have, because in every single instance up until now, we've always had those parties there. But in this instance, the party that has committed the allegedly wrongful act and that who otherwise would be estopped is saying, well, I can't be estopped because the nature of my wrongful act is such that that my opponent had no idea that this proceeding was ongoing.
But I would argue that's typically the case in another circumstance where another party is not a party to litigation where some kind of factual representation is made. I mean, they still wouldn't know in that circumstance, and this court has, at least as far as I know, adhered to the doctrine that the parties have to be the same.
Okay, thank you.
The doctrine of judicial estoppel has been referred to as a close cousin of the doctrine of approbation and reprobation because of the nature of what it involves. And in this particular case, what you have in the bankruptcy court is there is no claim. List all your claims. It's not there. There is no claim. And now what you have in this proceeding is, yes, there is a claim. I can't imagine anything that is more approbation and reprobation than that. And it's the same concept. It's also one of the reasons why it's not an affirmative defense, because you'd have to have a crystal ball to figure out what somebody didn't schedule. And it's only after the fact that you're able to, wait a minute, you said there wasn't a claim, now you say there is a claim. Why isn't Justice Mims correct that the bankruptcy proceeding as an in re proceeding actually fits even better to approbation and reprobation and consequently judicial estoppel than perhaps you have stated?
Justice Lemons, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
As I understand it, judicial estoppel has always been an affirmative defense in some sense. Now,
I don't think that's correct, but you go right ahead. I think the problem is that it has never been identified as an affirmative defense because it's impossible to do it that way. You'd have to have a crystal ball in pleadings to be able to plead it.
Well, Judge, I would suggest that the appropriate way to do that would be a motion to amend your pleadings, which are to be granted liberally in Virginia.
Well, you would concede that our case law is filled with a judicial estoppel being raised sui sponte by a court.
I have not found a case in Virginia state courts that raises that, at least at the appellate level, and I don't think at the trial level. Now, I have found many.
Trust us, we believe that a judge can sui sponte raise judicial estoppel.
Yes, sir.
So, that is there any other, if indeed your argument is accepted, that judicial estoppel is, in fact, an affirmative defense, is there any other affirmative defense that can be raised sui sponte by a judge? Simply just happen to think of it on the bench.
Unless standing is an affirmative defense, and I don't know that I would characterize it that way, I can't think of any others.
So, because judicial estoppel is ultimately intended to protect the court system itself, correct? That one of the reasons, whereas an affirmative defense is essentially something that well, never mind. I'm getting into my own philosophy at this point.
May I ask you this? Here you don't have a complete failure to disclose. You have a belated disclosure, correct?
That's true.
So prior to the discharge, and the trustee, as I read this, was aware of this claim, even though a dollar amount was assigned as opposed to the ad damnum of the personal injury claim. Does that make a difference to judicial estoppel when you have a belated disclosure as opposed to a complete failure to disclose?
I would argue in terms of if there is an exemption available, then I would argue that one of the prongs, which I believe is bad faith, is not met. And at least in the federal case law, that is viewed objectively, and objectively, if there is a possibility of exempting that does not show bad faith. And if I'm not mistaken, the Eastern District Bankruptcy Court in Indianola, which I've cited in our brief, raises that point. I would also point out that there is a case cited in our footnote in our reply brief that suggests that it is common practice for bankruptcy attorneys in Virginia to value things or value assets and list exemptions at $1. And the reason being is because you don't know the actual amount of what it may be worth, and then you later amend it to reflect the actual value and the actual exemption amount, and that is allowed in Virginia.
Well, convince me that... The analysis in Wiley, and convince me of why that's wrong.
I'm sorry?
I said the analysis in Wiley, which your opposing counsel cited. Can you tell me why that analysis is wrong? It's pretty simple. When a debtor has concealed...
Are you talking about the North Carolina case?
Yes.
Okay. Judge, I'm sorry, Justice McClanahan, our position on that is that even if something is not disclosed, it is still something that a debtor would have in a Chapter 13 case to make use of in order to cure indebtedness. Say he recovered a settlement of however much and got behind on his payments in the payment plan. He could use that money to catch up on the payment plan and at that point get a discharge. Now, if it had not been disclosed, that is certainly a potential sanction issue with the bankruptcy court. But, say, you know, other assets like a car that would be worth maybe $20,000 that was paid off, they didn't disclose that, he still may be using that to get back and forth to work every day. And if the court followed the analysis in the Wiley case, that would prevent the debtor from using this, even though, I mean, yes, it should be disclosed, regardless of whether there's actual knowledge of whether it should be disclosed. But at that point, he wouldn't be able to use it to cure indebtedness.
Can I, before you run out of time, ask you this last question?
Yes, sir.
Related to Justice McCullough's question. The $1 identification was after the confirmation order, but technically immediately before, shortly before the discharge order. So the Chapter 13 plan had been confirmed And while it's not over at that point, obviously, because it's a discharge order, that's when you need to know the assets. That's when all of the creditor's rights are fixed, because they figure they got all the assets on the table and the trustee's working it all out. Why is the judicial estoppel not able to attach there and not be unattached by, so to speak, the debtor getting caught in this inconsistency and trying to fix it at the last minute?
I think it would go back to the issue of whether there's good faith or bad faith. And as I read the cases, at least in the federal system, there's an issue of good faith or bad faith. And the Eastern District Bankruptcy Court of Missoula, I believe, did hold that if there's an exemption to be claimed, that normally that's not considered bad faith.
An exemption?
An exemption, yes, sir.
To be claimed.
Because, in other words, if the debtor can claim the exemption, then technically they wouldn't have any motive to hide something from a bankruptcy court, because it's not going to be able to, or it wouldn't have to be used in the computing the payment plan in any event.
Is this exempt?
At least according to his bankruptcy counsel, it is.
Well, isn't your best argument going to be based upon the nature of a Chapter 13 bankruptcy as opposed to a Chapter 7 bankruptcy? Because at the end of a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, all the debtors have been paid. So it doesn't matter whether you have $1 billion. You've already paid them the debts that you owe them, right?
You have paid some of the debts. You don't have to pay off all the unsecured creditors. And in most Chapter 13s, the unsecured creditors are not completely paid off.
Well, isn't it also true that there's compromises that are reached even by secured creditors in order to get the discharge from a 13?
Yes, sir. There can be if there's a portion of the secured debt that is actually unsecured, because there's more owed on say a car than the car is worth.
See, I guess that. Bankruptcy was not my strong suit, all right?
Yes, sir.
I guarantee you that my colleagues probably know a whole lot more about it than I do. But my thought, I think, is correct, that the idea of a 13 is we're going to marshal all the assets, and we think we can pull you out of here and get all the creditors paid, or at least make them happy, including unsecured creditors, if that's possible. And this is, quote, an asset that could be used for that purpose. My question to you, is it exempt, I guess is pretty important, because if it's exempt, it couldn't have been used anyway. But I never thought that
his bankruptcy counsel claimed a federal exemption. My thought is probably he had to do that because my client lived in Pennsylvania, had lived in Pennsylvania at a certain time before the bankruptcy was filed. If he did not claim the Virginia exemptions, then the only reason he would claim the federal exemptions is because of the fact that he was a resident of another state.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Janelle White for the appellees. Your Honors, there's no reasonable distinction between this Court's recent opinions in Ricketts against Strange and Coker versus Campbell and this case. Both those cases signify the importance placed on an orderly operation of the bankruptcy system and the importance of accurate disclosure.
Can I ask you the question that the Chief just asked your opposing counsel? What did the trial judge know or not know about the ability of this particular intangible inchoate asset to be exempted from a Chapter 13 plan?
I believe the trial court assumed that it just would be exempt. And so that was the assumption that we were operating under, that it would be exempt. But there are still U.S. district courts that have held that even if it is exempt, even in the Chapter 13 setting, that, again, there is an issue with acceleration of payments or compromise of secured or unsecured claims. And so that is the basis that we are operating.
Okay, educate us on that point. So it is clearly an intangible asset of the estate. It has to be scheduled. It should be scheduled. The law requires it to be scheduled. It wasn't.
Correct.
They get found out. They get caught. They now schedule it after the confirmation but before the discharge, and they put a dollar on it. So if you're conceding it's exempt, then whatever is a dollar or $5 billion, none of that money is going to anyone, but you're saying there are collateral effects that the debtor might want to avoid to ease the Chapter 13 plan through the bankruptcy court by not having identified it. What are they, and what legal basis do you have for it?
Yes, Your Honor, but I just wanted to be clear. I believe that the discharge had already occurred when there was an attempt to amend the schedules to add the $1.
That was after the discharge order?
Correct.
Okay.
That's my understanding. And the collateral effects are spelled out in some federal cases that, again, the analysis that the trustee undergoes, and again, I'm not the bankruptcy expert, but the analysis that the trustee undergoes is that he considers all the assets and makes that in formulating the payment plans or compromising some of the claims in the Chapter 13 plan. It all goes back to concealment of whether in Chapter 7 or Chapter 13. It's just not a practice that the court should validate by making a distinction. And the cases making such a distinction. The cases cited by the appellate in this case, the Wilson, Fourth Circuit case in Wilson, and the Eastern District case in Padula, those are what the cases, the way it should happen, that they get found out and they go and it's in the middle of the bankruptcy, and they go and they tell the court and they inform the trustee, and so they amend their schedules and they...
But their argument in this case is the trustee knew about this all along and he just didn't care, or she didn't care.
But the trustee did not know.
Okay. What did the trial judge know? That's what's important to us, as to what whoever else did or didn't know.
The trial judge knew what was included in the appendix attached to the motion for summary judgment, which was the original petition. And then attached to the motion to reconsider was the attempt to amend the schedule to declare it worth $1.
And you said that was post-discharge order?
Correct.
The amendment to the schedule?
The attempt to amend.
Was there ever a point in time where the other side said, you know, we need a hearing on this, Judge. You can't shoot from the hip on something like this. We need to bring in the trustee. I have affidavits I'd like to present. Anything like that?
That was not requested. And certainly I've considered the timing as to, I know that there's an issue, that the whole issue of the judicial estoppel argument and the timing of that. And it was raised, certainly, in a reply brief as a secondary position to the standing issue. But there was an invitation to submit additional authorities by the trial judge. There was an agreement then later to stay the effect of the trial judge's order, and then a motion for reconsideration on that issue. So there was plenty of time to present evidence on that issue, and none was, in fact, presented.
If it's exempt, and there's no question about it being exempt, and nobody's raising a question about it being exempt, what difference does it make?
It makes a difference to the integrity of the bankruptcy process.
Well, it may very well, but there's lots of ways to deal with that. You can deal with sanctions. You can deal with it all kinds of ways. But if it's exempt, and that's the question I'm asking, if it's exempt, why is this a proper subject for judicial estoppel?
Well, Your Honor, the assignment of error in this case, the underlying plaintiff did not take any issue with the factual predicate for the application of judicial estoppel in this case. Their only assignment of error in this case was as to the timing of it, which I believe the court has said it believes it could raise, the court could raise it sua sponte. So that's the only assignment of error in this case. And I think implicit in that being the only assignment of error is agreement with the factual predicate for the establishment of judicial estoppel, in that they were taking mutually contradictory positions in two different legal proceedings. And
it may not be agreement, but it's not a challenge. It's not a challenge by an appellant to the lower court, and therefore it's not before us. The merits of judicial estoppel, irrespective of whether or not the erasure is sponsored.
That is correct, Your Honor.
We have separate sovereigns here. We have federal bankruptcy, we have state courts. Must the state, what we're saying is judicial estoppel, we need to vindicate the integrity of the bankruptcy process in a separate proceeding at the state level. I mean, are there cases that talk about the importance of cross-sovereign judicial estoppel? I mean, one would think the federal courts are fully able to vindicate their own integrity of their process.
Certainly they are, but this court just recently in 2017 in Ricketts versus Strange spent a very considerable amount of time discussing why the protecting the integrity of the bankruptcy process is important. Ricketts against Strange was in a Chapter 7 context where the court looked at the specificity of what was disclosed.
That was a standing issue, wasn't it?
Correct, and that's the first assignment of error in this case, is the standing issue. And we don't think this case is distinguishable on any reasonable basis because of the court's emphasis.
Right, but that's a different argument from judicial stuff, right?
Correct, and I'm not aware of any cases that go to Your Honor's point of state courts protecting the integrity of federal proceedings. However, I don't think that the doctrine has ever made any distinction between...
And it may not. I just... it was just a point that jumped off the page at
me. Judicial process.
Did you finish your question? There are three aspects to judicial estoppel, one of them being that the prior court have relied on the inconsistent position. If this property is exempt, what is the reliance of the bankruptcy court on any statements that they make?
I hate to go back to the assignments of error, but the factual basis was not an assignment of error in this case, so that's certainly not something we briefed in this case. But again, there are the federal cases that go back to, that say, that is... All of the information needs to be before the bankruptcy court in order for the trustee to formulate a correct plan that is fair and to compromise any claims that may be before them.
It seems that I may very well have taken you off on a tangent, and I apologize, because I think your answer to my question is absolutely correct answer. Assignment of error 2, the trial court erred when the trial court ruled that the doctrine of judicial estoppel bars the appellant from pursuing the causes of action because the pleadings do not allege judicial estoppel as an affirmative defense.
Correct.
And that's your position is that all these are very interesting questions, perhaps including mine, which apparently is off the beam. But nonetheless, it's not before us.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I understand
that. Is assigned, the error assigned in this case.
So as far as you're concerned, we can simply say, no, you did an error by doing that. You can raise it to response.
That is correct. Again, the North Carolina case, getting back to the standing issue, before I move to the third, the cross assignment, the defamation issue. The North Carolina case, again, is not distinguishable from this in any. It's this very exact point, and what North Carolina chose to say is that you are not proceeding in behalf of the estate when the estate does not know about this claim.
You rely on this North Carolina case, which is obviously strongly in your favor, and your opposing counsel cites some Virginia bankruptcy cases. If we agree with you, are we creating tension within the state, where the state court is saying one thing about bankruptcy and the federal courts who are actually adjudicating the bankruptcies are saying something else, and we rely on North Carolina. Are we doing that or not?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, in the Ricketts against Strange, the court was very clear that state court rules control state court standing. And so that is an issue for this court and this court alone. But the second reason is that the two cases cited, the Fourth Circuit case in Wilson and the Eastern District case in Padula, were raised, one, Padula is most similar to this case, was raised in the bankruptcy court on a motion seeking leave to proceed in state court. So it's on different grounds. They were following the proper procedure. They were going back to the bankruptcy court and saying, bankruptcy court, please tell us what your ruling is in this case. They were two different procedural moments in time. And just briefly, I wanted to touch on the assignment of crosshair, which is the defamation.
Can I interrupt you before you do that? Tell me what I'm missing about this. The trial judge says no standing, and even if there were standing, judicial estoppel.
Correct.
There are alternative grounds. Either one of them is true means game over for the other side, right?
Correct.
So it comes up on appeal, and the challenge to the second alternative ground is he shouldn't have raised that sui sponte, and it wasn't pled as term for defense. Well, if the court were to answer, well, that's not a problem. Is there anything else in this case to talk about?
No, Your Honor. And just if, in case the case, the court does not decide that, I briefly wanted to touch on the defamation cross appeal, I assigned error to the trial court's decision that the complaint stated a cause of action for defamation per se. The defamation allegation was twofold, that my clients wrote in a letter saying that the plaintiff would, they were a third-party contractor, they were janitorial service to clean the building where the plaintiff worked. And the young ladies I represent wrote a letter to his employer saying that he would swear and use profanity quite often was one thing, and two, that he would call them honey, baby, sweetie, and ask them for hugs and otherwise act inappropriately. And we demurred to the complaint saying that certainly just did not rise to the level of defamation per se, that the plaintiff should be required to prove special damages, because while swearing and calling female contractors honey, baby, sweetie may lower the plaintiff in the esteem of people, the requirement in Virginia is that it must touch upon the particular trade, business, or occupation, such as examples of this have been allegations of unethical conduct against a lawyer. We're required to act ethically. That's a requirement of our trade, business, or occupation. Allegations that an accountant can't do math, or allegations that a surgeon's hand shakes. Obviously, those have a specific nexus to the requirements of the job of the plaintiff.
Before your time expires, why do we even need to analyze whether it's defamation per se or not when it was pleaded alternatively that there were special damages?
If it goes back and there is a trial conducted in this case, it will become relevant, I believe, at a motion to strike stage. If the plaintiff fails to prove special damages, it will become highly relevant as to whether he has proven a cause of action at that point.
Okay.
And so just...
One of the things that you obviously know is that when we finish this proceeding, we go upstairs and talk about this case, and you don't get to sit at our table. Consequently, you don't know what we're going to decide, and that's why you want to talk about it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, I understand that, and you're absolutely right.
I believe my time has expired.
Yes, indeed. Your time has expired. Call the next case.